and welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A new podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas
of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is
produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based
nonprofit organization
supporting the development and use
of open education globally.
Learn more about us
at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at a global level.
We hope to bring you closer
to how open education is working
by hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you
to a global open educator,
and we invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
We're here for an episode of OEG Voices, the podcast running from Open Education Global. I'm the host, Alan Levine, and I'm really pleased again to be joined with my colleagues today, Marcelo Morales and Una Daly. And so how is your day going so far?
Oh, good. Beautiful day. Beautiful sunny day in Texas. Really happy to be here and getting an opportunity to learn a little bit more about Uber's work.
Yes, same here. I'm thrilled to have a one-on-one, so to speak, with Apurva. I haven't had that opportunity before.
Yes, yes. And I'll say that too, because we crossed paths on one of our many projects. But the whole point of these conversations is that right now, applications are open for nominating someone, a project, a person. Think of someone that you know that means a lot to your work in open education, like Apurva, for the 2021 Open Education Awards for Excellence. And so we have till July 19th, right, Marcelo?
Correct.
Yeah, what we've wanted to do is to sort of bring to you the voices and stories of people who've won in previous years. And so we're kind of just catching up to 2020, but we'd like you to hear these. So this might even give you ideas for who to nominate for this year, but also more just to get some more insight into their work. So we're all very excited today to be talking with Apurva Ashok from Rebus Community, who got a 2020 Award for Excellence in the Support Specialist category, which probably doesn't really fully encompass all that she does when you read the description from the person who nominated with her. But we really want to get a chance to hear about Apurva and like what drives her and what she enjoys about her work in Rebus Community. So welcome, Apurva, and tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do with Rebus.
Thank you so much, Alan, and Una, Marcela, so lovely to be having this opportunity to chat one-on-one. We've seen each other in the past, and I'm very grateful to be able to get the chance to sit down for an hour and just talk about all of the things we're passionate about. I will start by saying I am from Bangalore, India. I am currently located in Toronto. I'm based on the traditional lands of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the First Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. I'm very grateful to be here as an immigrant and to learn so much more about life here and to be able to join and play my small role in this global open education field from Toronto.
Small role, not judging from what the people said about you. So how do you describe like the work of open education to people who may be a little bit outside the scope of people we normally interact with? Like, how do you make the case for it or explain the work that you do?
I think it's always a tough field to explain. I find myself starting very broad and sort of narrowing in based on who I'm talking to. I think just very generally, I tell folks I'm working to make education more affordable, improve the quality of education, improve access to education. These three broad buckets tend to immediately connect with people. I see a multidimensional aspect to the work that I do. I see facets of publishing in my work. I see facets of academia, see facets of open education. So depending on who I'm talking to, if they're familiar with the publishing world, I dive into the OER creation and production aspects. If they're coming more from an academic background, I tell them a little bit about the facilitation work involved, the teaching and learning, or the pedagogy sides of open education. I find that just broadly letting people know that I work for a Canadian charity, Rebus Foundation, specifically on a project that is focused on open education, publishing, and community building, tends to get the message across.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit more about Rebus, and the community part that you work on? What do they do?
Sure thing. So the Rebus Foundation is a Canadian charity. It was founded by Hugh McGuire and Boris Anthony back in 2015 or 2016. Someone will need to fact check that. But the Rebus community in particular is sort of the open education arm. It focuses on providing anything from just support and free resources for people who are looking to create OER or adopt OER. But we also offer professional development training, webinars, and really do our best to try to connect people around the world as they are embarking on their open education journeys, whether it's coming to it for the first time or working on their fifth or sixth or seventh OER project.
And how did you come to be working with Rebus, and sort of what was your pathway into this? Were you already an expert in open education?
Definitely not. And I think I, like many people in OER, have a different journey to open education. So I like to say that I sidestepped my way into open education. Probably many children who read a lot growing up, I wanted to be an author and went to college to get an English literature degree, hoping that that would somehow take me down that path. Grew very dissatisfied with academia and instead opted to do a Master of Publishing degree from Simon Fraser University here in Canada, and was very lucky to find an internship opportunity at the Rebus Foundation. So as part of my master's degree, I spent 4 months learning and working alongside faculty and librarians and other educators who are working on creating open educational resources. So that was sort of my first point of contact with open education. I also had an excellent professor by the name Juan Pablo Alperin, who introduced Hypothesis as an annotation tool that we used in the classroom. So it was really in my college years that I learned about open education as a movement, as a concept. And once I graduated, I wanted to stay in the field. I was very lucky that Rebus found ways to keep me on full time, and that sort of charted the journey.
Like, what's involved in this community work? Because, you know, you probably don't get to directly contact. You have a lot of contact communications with people, but a lot of it is through these digital channels. Like, so how do you go about sort of creating these relationships that are effective in building the community?
Great question. And something that we've done a lot of thinking around on the Rebus community side is offering many pathways in for people to come and connect. I think just having one channel alone is not going to be good enough for folks who might have different needs and coming from different contexts. So very simply, on the Rebus community, we have a free public forum. Anyone can, with an internet connection, can join the forum, create an account, connect with members around the world. So you could connect with, I've seen a lot of your names on the forum as well. There's always the various listservs that we keep an eye on to reach out to folks. Una, you do a fabulous job of being present in the CCC OER listserv, which I think is a big one for us educators in North America.
In the community college sector.
In the community college sector, definitely. And there's a lot of other open education listservs where we try to reach people. But broadly, it's through our forum, and I'll say just through all of these various events that come together, right? You have the OE Global Conference, you have the Open Education Conference, but you also have a lot of free webinars and events that community groups are putting together, whether it's the H5P kitchen that I know, Alan, you host, or other events like that. So community work, I think, shows up in a lot of different places. What I try to do on my end is to facilitate some of that through the Textbook Success Program, which is a professional development training program for librarians, faculty, instructional designers. And I really try to bring folks together as a community of practice, as a learning community, and keep them engaged for a full year as they're working on their OER projects. So I try to build in some of those community moments into the programs that I facilitate or help facilitate.
Yeah, and that's such a fabulous program and resource for anybody who's wants to take on this thing, because it can be daunting. Like to say, like, oh, I think I want to do an open textbook, and you think, oh, I'm just going to be writing. No, wait a minute, there's a whole lot more that goes into it, and you have the whole methodology.
I was just sitting in on a session this morning where one of our alumni facilitators was talking about team building. And he started off by saying, you know, it's not just the author that makes the OER. There is a whole team behind it. And it takes many hands to build a resource that is usable and can meet the needs of all learners.
We talked a little bit about your program over email, Apurva, the professional development. opportunity, that 1 year opportunity. And I know that some institutions have support for their faculty, but others don't. And so when they receive perhaps a grant, a grant stipend or something, and they're kind of on their own to do that, I think this must be really useful and provides that support. And I wonder if you can tell us about, maybe give us an example of one of the books that happened recently, maybe this year or something.
Sure. One that's coming to mind immediately is the Open Pedagogy Approaches text. And I know it's not a traditional textbook per se. It's more of a monograph or a series of collections. We were very lucky to have Alexis Clifton and Kimberly Davis Hoffman, part of one of our cohorts. And they really came together and not only, I think, got a lot out of just that cohort model, community model, where they could come and ask questions about how do we format XYZ in the publishing tool that we're using, or how do we go about managing this large team of authors that are spread all across the world. But they were also able to share back and go back to the cohort and say, we're further along the process than you, and here are all of the guides and the pieces of documentation that we've developed for this book that we think might be useful for you as you enter, say, the review and feedback stage. You can repurpose a lot of these documents instead of having to create them anew.
Yeah. And, we actually interviewed Alexis and one of the authors, Cynthia Orozco, earlier on that. So when you talk about these resources they produced, did they produce them for folks within their system, and obviously they would be shareable with the whole community, but that's really wonderful that they're actually producing besides just the product, but all these wonderful ancillary resources.
And the nice thing was, as part of this process, I think they also decided to put that all together in the book's back matter. So now anyone who's accessing the book can go in and say, okay, these were the resources that were used in making the book. I can download this call for proposals or rubric to evaluate certain pieces of the content and repurpose it for my needs. So it's the sharing across communities that I really enjoy hearing about in the TSB. And Una, you mentioned, specifically for faculty and educators who don't have this type of institutional support where they're located, that can be especially useful. I think it's also useful for those that may have a lot of additional support to be able to give back and to share. Mm. And, you probably have all heard or experienced or thought this at some point. No support can be too much support. Just showing up and being there, whether it's for your faculty that you're supporting or for the students that you are teaching, just giving them as much as they need or as much as they can take can always be helpful.
I wanted to ask at some point about maybe a book that you've worked on within this community that had student contributions. We can wait on that one till later.
Sure. Happy to wait if you wanted.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we love to hear these.
All right. Well, a few are coming to mind, and I'll say some may be formally in the Textbook Success Program, but others that I've worked on prior to the program was officially launched. And to give you a little bit of the backstory, the program really came together as a result of hands-on work with projects. I mean, we started out working and doing a lot of project management and publishing work with faculty in order to get a sense of what publishing entails. What are the experiences or challenges that educators face as they are putting together a book? And we sort of condensed all of that knowledge into the program. And in those early days, we were really grateful to work alongside folks like Robin DeRosa, who worked on that open anthology of earlier American literature that inspired a lot of work at Rebus down the road. I can also think of the anthology of Hispanic literature that Julie Ward put together with her students, where she put together an open pedagogy assignment asking students to write critical introductions to select excerpts of literature that she had pulled together. So those are two that's coming to mind. And I know that Rebus has put out a guide to making open textbooks with students that I think was featured by OE Global at one point, maybe in 2018. So lots of different ways that open pedagogy or open educational practices come into TSB, whether it's working with students to create new content or just coordinating with students to get feedback about books. I can think of Dave Dillon's Blueprint for Success, which is one of the books that we've previously supported. And I worked closely with Dave just to take in all of the student feedback that he was getting as he was using his really large 500-page text in his classroom. And students were giving us a lot of input just on, you know, the format and the layout, but all the way to it would be more useful if the content could go more in depth in these particular concepts. I think hearing from students is just as important as hearing from what we call the subject matter experts, the peer reviewers. So something that I like to do, and we try to do at Rebus, is to elevate that level of student feedback and student involvement to the same level of peer involvement or subject matter expert involvement.
That's becoming really important in our mm-hmm. open education community is the use of open pedagogy. You know, so for students, either co-curation of materials or co-development, and really supporting that. So
those kind of projects sound like, you know, some of the things we're trying to do to get faculty think, if you're doing your first open pedagogy assignment, like doing a 500 page open textbook looks large, but doing something which is student contributions or perhaps participating along with, you know, a group authored project is a good entry point. And the other thoughts are sort of like when someone says, hey, I'm really interested in this open pedagogy stuff, where do I start?
It can be hard for someone to figure out where to take a step in. And a lot of those smaller projects, which is just encourage your students to license maybe the assignments they're creating openly. Teach them a little bit about copyright and about Creative Commons licensing. That could be a small entry point into maybe a larger project where they're contributing to a tech. There's a lot of pathways in, and I found that in my work, the word publishing often limits how people think about open. I think with publishing, people assume that it's all about producing the work, having it released, getting it out there, and then the cycle ends there. But I've learned that the life cycle of the book extends so much more beyond that. And I'm using the word book very broadly. I'm thinking about books as textbooks or lab manuals or ancillary materials. Publishing is also what happens after you use the texts and you revise and you reiterate and you remix and improve upon it as it's being used. It doesn't just end with the official, you know, release date.
Yeah. And I was thinking, because when you're telling your story about how, you know, you got, you know, introduced to Hypothesis. And so I'm really interested. I mean, to me, that's one way to take the textbook beyond the publishing part, is where you sort of take on this activity of having students participate in commentary discussion on top of that. Have you seen a lot of good examples of people doing that kind of work?
I've seen a few good examples. Definitely with all the literature projects that I've supported, it Hypothesis as a tool seems to lend itself very well to that type of discussion. I know that in my own experience of using Hypothesis, what I found really helpful as a learner was just to learn more about critical reading skills. Like, what are my peers, my fellow classmates thinking about as they're reading a particular text? And it really encourages a very different kind of conversation within the classroom versus one where you know, you're coming in and you're expected to say something very deep or insightful about an assigned reading. It really changes the landscape within the classroom.
I have to say, you must love learning, because when I think about all the different subject areas you've been, yeah, and the project I remember meeting you on was about guitar tab notation.
Yes.
And it's like, oh my gosh, a perfect must be like are there any like subject areas or topics that you said, oh my God, how am I gonna, you know, figure out how to help someone in this area?
All the music books are definitely a challenge when it comes to the notation, and of course the video and audio that have to be embedded. And the book that Alan mentioned was Sight Reading for Guitar by Chelsea Green out of the American University in Cairo, with a lot of lovely help from Nadine Abulmagd and Maha Bailey. So that was a fabulous book. But other disciplines that I'm thinking of, we had very recently a historical geology lab manual that we were supporting out of the University of Houston. That was a challenging one because they wanted to incorporate, you know, some 3D graphs in there, and it was primarily a lab manual, so meant to be used and filled in by students in a number of different ways. I find a lot of the math and science texts can be tough as well, as you're thinking about how do you leverage all of the affordances of making digital OER, making interactive OER, but with being conscious of the accessibility needs of students who might need print copies of these texts. Yeah, there's a whole gamut. I could give you a list of disciplines and subjects.
Oh, we get that. We could certainly tell what range that you cover. There don't seem to be.
I have a technical question. So, you know, if a faculty member is using a Pressbooks published material, OER, that has been published in the Pressbooks platform, and they want to support Hypothesis in order to have students annotate along with them. Do they have to export it into another format, or they can do it directly in the Pressbooks?
They can do it directly in Pressbooks. And I see Alan shaking his head as well, so I'll clarify. From what I know, I think Hypothesis is just a web annotation tool. So really any website that you come across, okay. If you have the Hypothesis extension in your browser, you can go ahead and annotate. And that could be, you know, your news website that you go to. It could be your book on Pressbooks, as long as it's publicly available. Yes. Or it could be something within your LMS if you have it further embedded.
Yeah, and Pressbooks actually has the support built in. So you can say, it becomes easier for students. You can say, like, I want annotation to be automatically enabled for chapters 1 through 8 or the entire book. And so when anyone comes across that book, the annotation tools are right there on it. So it's really, the beauty of it is that, like a purpose describing it, it's almost like a conversation layer that can exist on any public web page.
Great. I wasn't absolutely sure how that worked. That sounds wonderful. So as we start up a new program with Open Pedagogy and faculty next fall, that's a tool that didn't discuss it last year. So we'll make sure we do this year.
That'll be great. And I've also seen Hypothesis being used, at least in the production side, for peer review. So sometimes people get a book into whatever publishing tool they're using and ask the reviewers to go through it and leave annotations or notes via Hypothesis rather than sending out an email or a memo or sort of another Word document file. Yes. They're giving you inline commentary, and that's a nice way for them to get familiar with the tool. So if that reviewer is going to end up potentially adopting that OER that they've just reviewed, then they also are learning this new skill, this new tool that they may be able to take back into the classroom.
Yeah, because in the past we've said, you know, you should do it in Google Docs first so you can get all your peer review comments in and then you can move it into your platform. But it's great to hear that you can be in the publishing platform earlier.
Yeah, and you know, that's also been especially useful from what I've seen for accessibility review. So once the book is in the final format, how do you conduct that audit to make sure it meets, at least from a technical accessibility, all of those various standards to make sure?
Oh, I see. So you would actually, the accessibility expert would perform the audit in Pressbooks and be able to then let them know what changes needed to be made.
Yeah, they could use Hypothesis if they wanted to and say, okay, I'm seeing XYZ that needs changing in chapter 4. And they're leaving those comments in chapter 4.
Yeah, yeah.
Right at the place where the edit, you know, matters. Like, yeah.
Because from once it's in the publishing format, that's a lot more real than the text in a Word type doc. Okay.
In a way, I'll say, you know, I think what we're seeing with OER is they're constantly changing. They can be revised over time. So as real as it feels in the publishing platform, knowing that that can change, like there's no hard and fast. It's not set in cement.
Well, I want to thank you, Apurva, because I'm trying to get my OEG colleagues excited about web annotation. So we didn't conspire behind the scenes. It just happened, right?
It's very naturally formed. Yeah.
I'm so excited to hear you paint this beautiful, diverse landscape of everything that you do. And I'm just thinking how fitting that Support Specialist Award was for you, because you're so diverse and you do so many things. And also, I would like to mention that the descriptions that we received from your colleagues of being like the support person to go to when creating OER, and that how faculty came to you for answers and opinions. And I do wonder, what is the number one challenge that you see from faculty when creating OER or adopting OER? What is a consistent challenge that you get?
That's an excellent question and a tough one to answer. I'm filtering through a lot of the different scenarios that have come to mind. I think, like, broadly, if I were to try to find a pattern amongst all of them, the big one is not knowing where to start. I think people come in with the idea of, I want to make an OER and I know why this is good or it can help improve my pedagogy. And I think once they start to get into the weeds, they look at a long list of, are these all of the things that I need to do? Or, okay, I thought I was just thinking about writing a text. Now you're asking me to think about writing accessibly. You're asking me to think about writing with inclusion in mind, with cultural relevancy in mind. So I think they tend to get a little overwhelmed. So people probably come and ask, where do I start? what are the small steps in, which Alan was alluding to earlier with the students, that can also happen with the faculty as well. How do I begin this process of publishing OER? And oftentimes it's, let's sit back and make a plan. Let's just plan out and scope out all of the work. And once you have that on paper, even if we don't stick to the timelines that we're indicating here, that can be reassuring. That's the big question that comes up from what I can look back and reflect on.
Do you see indications there that, like, sometimes I find that people question the value of what they, of their ideas, like they worry about how they're being judged. It's like, I'm no Robin DeRosa. Like, I'm just, you know, little Alan Levine teaching here, you know, and people often, I think they overly self-criticize their own ideas before they even get to the creation stage.
Yeah, I think we're all victims of that in some sense. And, you know, that's one of the challenging but also rewarding things of the support sort of category of work that I find myself in, which is letting folks know that they do have the capacity, ability, confidence, whatever it is to tackle that task, that their ideas are valid, that the opinions they're bringing to the table, the skills and the perspectives that they're coming with, all deserve to be there and deserve to be heard and seen by students. And it's really just, I think, was it last episode or the episode previously, what Amy said, you know, the most rewarding thing is just the people and being able to let people succeed and thrive and really bring them out of that shell of self-doubt or self-criticism and really enable them to move forward, whether as a teacher, whether as a librarian, faculty member, or whatever other role they inhabit within the institution.
Or when they hear the one we just published with Allegria, Nara at CSU Pueblo, like her energy is infectious, and so is yours. So
I caught a few bits of that episode. I have to listen to it in full, but I was really struck by, you know, when she was talking about how students would come with language and sort of speak these language in their homes and not really realize that this was in fact worth sharing more broadly. It was really wonderful to hear. And part of me thinks, and I wondered if you all agree, is isn't that what our purpose is as educators, is to help people lead better lives, but also in realizing their own self-worth, lead better lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're going to quote you on that one. So.
Yeah. Well, CCBY, feel free to take it.
You heard it here. So anything new that you're just looking at taking on that's exciting you in terms of your work with Rebus?
Thank you for that question. Something that I'm really thrilled about is just to be able to grow the TSB. So we started out working back when Rebus was founded with about 10 or so pilot projects, we called them. And we launched the TSB officially in October 2019. And we've since then seen about over 70 people graduate. And we're currently working with a few different cohorts right now and have almost 60 people enrolled. So it's just really exciting for me to see the program grow and to bring in all of those graduates and alumni and give them opportunities for further professional growth. So this time around, our cohorts are being led by faculty alumni, similar to that Creative Commons facilitator model that we've seen. You know, we're looking at what models have worked well for people, and we're trying to use the same on our end. And that for me is really exciting. This is not just Rebus working with a small set of people, but Rebus really trying to find ways to share this knowledge and spread this knowledge more widely and empower people to do the same.
Excellent. Yeah. Like, I mean, the things you describe, I mean, we've known about the value of cohorts for a while. It's becoming this buzzword now out there because people realizing it's just not content, but the fact that
the relationship building, it's the community of practice. It's the people.
Totally. So
without the people, you can quote me on that, Alan.
I am. Give me the license, Una.
I did.
Okay.
Say, speaking of the people, you know, I do want to flag that you've all been very generous to talk about me so far, but the TSB, the Textbook Success Program in Rebus, is not just me alone. And I do want to give some credit to all the folks in hands who've helped build along the way. So obviously Hugh, who founded the charity and started the initiative, but Zoe Wake-Hyde, who was an integral part of building the program, Elizabeth Mays, who also put in a lot of time and effort, Lee Kinch-Pedrosa, who helped with marketing, Dexter Colasuria, who was a community manager at Times, David Santo, and now Monica Brown, who is the assistant program manager. These are just some of the central names. I can think of plenty others who have helped along the way. And I do want to flag that, you know, everything that we're talking about in this hour is not the product of just one person, but really is a hugely collaborative effort from folks around the world. And I hope that that's evident in the resources that folks might be picking up and seeing, you know, because it is really work of the people. Give them credit when it's due.
It's completely evident in just about everything that you said. If someone's interested in TSP, how do they get involved?
Oh, they can just head over to rebus.community and there should be a little button that says programs where you can learn more. That's a great way to get involved. If you are on the Rebus community forum, rebus.community, you can make your way through various categories. All of the resources that we're creating for the TSP are openly licensed. So even if you cannot attend the program yourself, you can still access all of the materials for free and sort of read them and go through the content in your own time.
I really want to thank you so much. This has been such, I get the most out of these conversations, I think, because it's just so great to learn and to meet people and to see them in this small environment. So thank you so much, Apoorva, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the honor of the award. It was quite a shock to hear about it at the time and to see all the other wonderful winners over the past year and to hear about their stories through the podcast as well. So I really appreciate all of you just carving out, you know, this space and recognizing the set of work and that happens in the field. And of course, for inviting me on here today to tell you a little more about it.
Well, it's fun. And so we want to thank everybody who's listening to this episode when we get it published. This is OEG Voices. And again, it's coming to you from Open Education Global. When you hear this, there'll be some little bit of music in the beginning and the end. It's a track I found called Joyful Meeting, which is how these meetings feel. It's by an artist named Crow Wander, and it's from the Free Music Archive, licensed Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial. And so you'll find this episode when Alan gets to editing it, because there's a pile of them, but hopefully in a couple of weeks we'll be able to share this or sooner. It'll be there at voices.oeglobal.org, and we really hope that you sort of follow up with Apoorva with questions either in the Rebus community or within our OEG Connect. And anybody out there who has an interesting project they want to share or someone that they think we should feature on this podcast, please let us know. And so we just want as many voices as we can that we can feature here. So thank you, everybody, again, for spending this time with us.